Hello and welcome to Essential Knowledge Updates, or EKU, podcasts from the Royal College of General Practitioners. My name is Dr. Thomas Round and I'm a GP and Academic Clinical Research Fellow. I've also recently taken over as the EKU Development Fellow following the fantastic work of Dr. Dirk Pilat. Welcome to EKU 10 podcast. Talking now to Sally Higginbottom, a GP who's done a review of two pieces of work. One is a GMC report into quality and safety in prescribing in UK general practice. And linked with this, Sally's also had a look at a BMG ethnographic study looking at, I think, receptionists and repeat prescribing, so kind of complementing each other. So Sally, good to speak to you. Any kind of initial thoughts of how you found this module?
It was quite different to most of the other modules I've been involved in, either sort of writing or doing, because it wasn't a specific clinical topic, but a broader issue around prescribing more generally. The two papers were quite different in tone. The GMC paper was very comprehensive, large study, looking at the same issue from lots of perspectives, whereas the BMJ article was very local in that they looked at four different practices in great detail in real life as opposed to from the literature. So they were quite different approaches. So it was interesting looking at the two together.
And do you think they work well together? And they're kind of giving some different angles?
I think they did, yes. I think you've got almost like a sort of more theoretical approach from the GMC papers and sort of what people reported and the results of critical incidents, and whereas a slightly more human touch from the BMJ paper, which the most striking thing was that there was a huge difference between what people's protocol said and what actually happened in the practices, which I think is quite important, probably for a number of issues, but particularly for prescribing.
So maybe we could look at both in a bit more detail, and then we can kind of tease out any issues that have come up which are applicable to GPs. So can you describe a bit more detail the GMC study? Was that work they'd done themselves, or were they reviewing other literature? Or
it was a mixed study. So they did a large systematic review of the literature and to look at the history of prescribing and prescribing errors. They then looked themselves as a new study at the records of 1,700 patients across 15 practices and reviewed those with a pharmacist for errors and looked at all possible causes of that. They did some root cause analysis of a number of errors, and then they had focus groups and interviews with primary healthcare professionals, and then they pulled all that together in a series of conclusions.
Taking some of those issues and any kind of take-home key kind of facts for our listeners?
I think the thing that struck me in terms of practical prescribing was that there was no indication that GPs who were more experienced or less experienced made more or fewer mistakes. It wasn't anything to do with any particular practices, individual processes. But the things which did increase the error rate, and which we should probably bear in mind, is not surprisingly, patients who were on a lot of medications had a higher risk of errors. And another biggie was a failure to reconcile data that had come in and discharge summaries, particularly with the patient's record. And that was a big source of errors. And I think we can all quite see why that happens. The other thing that I found particularly interesting was they had a long list of strategies which people use to reduce errors when they discuss things with them. Particularly appealing are the sort of practice-wide defences, the things that can be put in place either in IT systems or across the practice. So things like using a practice formulary and training the staff that are involved in repeat prescribing, using a sort of subset of the staff rather than any receptionist just doing a bit of it, because expertise can develop if you've got a smaller team involved.
I was just having a quick look through. So what kind of is a scale of error, do we think?
Well, it kind of depends how you define it.
Yeah.
I mean, the GMCA paper says between 1% and 40% of prescriptions have some sort of error, depending on your definitions.
Yeah.
At the 40% end, that includes anyone where you've just written as directed, as opposed to putting a proper dosing schedule on.
I'll be guilty of that one.
Well, yes, most of us would.
With creams and things.
Yes, absolutely. Wouldn't feel too bad about that particular sort. In terms of actual harm, we know they're responsible for about a quarter of litigation claims, so they're clearly quite important from that angle. When they looked at the actual study they did, where they looked at 1,700 records, they found 11 severe errors. So only 0.18% of prescriptions were associated with severe errors. And of those 11 errors, 9 were all warfarin prescribing, which I think is quite a clear risky area. And we all know it's risky. Certainly my practice, recent innovation over about the last 18 months, was that no one is prescribed warfarin without you having a photocopy of their yellow book in your hand so that you're sure you're prescribing the right dose and you've got a recent INR. And it's a very onerous system because you've got to get reception trained to photocopy books and hand over all the right bits of paper. But I think looking at this, as pretty much all of the serious events when they looked at this were related to warfarin, it's probably the one area we could focus on most helpfully.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So their definition of severe error, would it be that a risk of severe patient, you know, kind of an INR going too high or misprescribing warfarin, so risk of death or morbidity?
Absolutely, risk of serious clinical adverse outcome, yeah. The other two errors, that out of the 11, 9 were warfarin errors, and the other two were people being prescribed something they were allergic to, which, yeah, should be fairly avoidable with modern IT systems. But I wonder if that's something to do with the number of alerts that pops up sometimes when you try and prescribe something and people just ignoring them all because they get so many alerts, most of which are irrelevant.
Or I guess possibly new patients registering and the alert not being put on or transferred from a previous practice.
Yes,
onto the notes.
Possible, or not coded correctly, so pre-texted, or so it doesn't, the prescribing module wasn't aware.
And also I read some of the other ones, they said the majority included warfarin, and there was also on there statins and ramipril and benzofluazide were on that list.
Yes, of the drugs associated with any errors, those were the commonest ones. I don't think that was adjusted for how frequently those drugs are prescribed, and obviously those drugs are prescribed very frequently, but the particular issue with simvastatin, ramipril and benzofluazide were about monitoring, were about having had recent blood tests, essentially. I guess those are by far the most commonly monitored drugs we're now using in primary care, particularly as we've been busy taking our patients off the more expensive versions of any of those classes. And so I think that's why it's there. I guess with QOF, most of these patients should be flagged up anyway, in terms of their monitoring bloods. So it may be just be a case of double checking all the patients on those registers have had their bloods checked, rather than just until you've got to the 90% or whatever the thresholds are, to ensure the safety.
I'd be interested to know what was their definition of monitoring for statins, because obviously when I initiate, I kind of do LFTs generally kind of a couple of weeks later, sometimes 4 to 6 weeks later. Are they saying that they would recommend regular kind of yearly monitoring of LFTs, or was there kind of like a criteria for that?
My understanding is they were looking for annual LFT monitoring, and I think they gave a 50% plus or minus kind of range, so you know 18 months would have been reasonable. I think that, as I understand, different people are suggesting whether you should or shouldn't do regular monitoring of LFTs on statins. Most of these patients are going to be high risk for metabolic syndrome and fatty liver and those sorts of issues, which we addressed in one of the previous EKUs, so that would be another reason possibly to keep an eye on their LFTs. But that was what they were looking for in this study.
We're giving more and more patients statins, and the question is actually, is the evidence suggesting actually, from what I understand from the evidence, it's you need 3 times your upper limit of normal for your liver function test before you come off it. So it's a question about whether what's kind of the right or wrong approach for that.
Yes, I mean, in real life, I think once ever I've seen someone actually do that to their liver with a statin in all the many, many patients I've seen on them. So, I haven't looked at what the evidence is behind us saying we should do it, but they were just checking against the checklist of recommended monitoring tests.
Summarising the GMC paper, and how do you think it will change? Will it change anything in your practice, kind of working as a coalface GP? What do you think you might do differently? Or
one thing that I was struck by is the idea of using EMIS practice notes or equivalent to sort of flag up issues with prescriptions that receptionists are querying, rather than a whole series of bits of paper that are scribbled on and post-it notes and things stapled to each other, which has no then audit trail, because that all then gets shredded once you've issued your prescription. And I think it would be a lot safer probably if you had a note that was linked to the patient record saying this is what the issue is with this prescription, so then you can see exactly what the thought process has been. But that's something I'll take back to our practice to look at.
Maybe we should move on to BMJ study, which was a qualitative study in 4 practices of reception staff.
The researchers spent, I think, about 50 hours in total sitting in 4 practices, watching the whole repeat prescribing process. So this was very much, this was completely focused on repeat prescribing, not acute prescribing.
Yes.
And they defined repeat prescribing as prescribing that happened without a consultation, which I've not really thought about before. But so repeat prescribing happened without anyone talking or seeing the patient. And they followed the processes right through from how patients made requests and then whichever staff were involved in that bit, whether those were dedicated prescribing staff or reception or admin staff, And then what happened as that came through to the doctors, either just for signature or for something to be sorted out, and then how the prescription got back to the patient. And they looked at both what the protocols, a couple of the practices had clear protocols said, but they also looked at what actually happened, and there was quite a big gap between the two. What was really striking was how different practices were in terms of how they approached repeat prescribing, and how it sort of reflected the practice ethos. So a small, very sort of very friendly, teamworky sort of practice had a repeat prescribing process, which was very much concentrated on sort of continuity of care, people knowing the patients, a receptionist saying, oh yes, that's Mrs. Smith, she always gets that on a Tuesday, as opposed to a practice at the other end of the scale, which was very protocol driven, business orientated, had a very customer focused sort of approach, which was a bit more like phoning a call centre, kind of, there was a script and the receptionist was supposed to stick to the script. So it was a very, yeah, it reflected something of the practice ethos, how they did their repeat prescribing.
Yeah, and obviously repeat prescribing is a huge part of what we do with a lot of patients, and increasing amounts of multi-comorbidity and ageing population. It's going to become an ever more increasing and an important part of what we do. What kind of insights and take-home messages did you kind of get from this piece of work that you could maybe take back again to your practice?
There were two things that really struck me. One was when they looked at it, over half of the requests from patients for repeat prescribing were not straightforward. So there was something that the receptionist couldn't just issue, either because there was they were overdue a review, or they were overusing or underusing, or it was a drug that was no longer on their repeat screen, or there was a problem with it.
Yes.
And so I think instead of us seeing that as the exception to the rule, it really is the norm, that what patients think they can just get on repeat, there's often a problem with. I think the other really striking thing was the gap between the protocols and the reality, and the importance if you are, particularly if you're leading in a practice, if you're a prescribing lead or your partner, that you need to have a really good protocol, but you also need to actually sit down and talk to people and watch what happens in real life, because you can't guarantee that what you've written down, however well you've trained people, is actually what happens. I mean, receptionists were routinely keeping little books of knowledge that they used between them and shared, and wrote down little things that said, you know, methotrexate dangerous, don't issue unless the doctor said, kind of little nuggets of information that they were using together. But you sort of, as a clinician, you want to know about that, so
absolutely,
that you can have some input into what the informal knowledge within the practice is coming together for them.
I guess that's applicable to lots of different systems. So you can have a protocol, and protocol's all well and good, but actually you need to kind of make sure what's going on in the ground is kind of matching that, or if there's any kind of issues, make sure you kind of know what's kind of going on. And that's really interesting about not straightforward. So, and that's often again a gap, I guess, demonstrating a gap between what we'd hope patients would do and what they actually do. So I guess it's kind of flagged up on our systems under or overusing meds. And, you know, that's often the case, isn't it? When a patient's using meds, they might not be fully compliant with it. Compliance is a huge problem. And obviously that then shows up on when they're trying to get repeat prescriptions, they're kind of under overusage.
Yes, and the sort of range of reasons why it might be out of sync, from, you know, that I'm going on holiday so I need a bit extra, to the, you know, well, the hospital issued me a couple of weeks, so I don't need that one yet, which is why it now looks like I'm underusing that one. So the very innocent sort of things to patients who just requesting essentially things that were never put on repeat, but they would just like some more of, please. And with the downward pressure on prescribing costs being very key at the moment, we're busy taking lots of things off repeat that the patient still wants, in terms of creams and rub-on things and all sorts of things that that the prescribing advisors want us to stop. So I think we're going to get even more of this sort of conflict between what the patient wants on repeat and what we're prepared to just issue.
And any other kind of take-home messages?
I think we've covered most of it, but I think it is interesting for us all to think about the prescriptions we're signing when we're given a box of repeats, not just what the prescription says, which we probably have a quick look at, but also a quick think through the process of what's happened to get it to that point. We're all aware that you need to be able to trust the nurse who's brought your prescription that you're about to sign, but actually you've also got to be able to trust the process in a practice that's generated a repeat, and all the people in that chain, that's the sort of safe system. Otherwise, we're all at risk if you're medically legally, if you're...
And I guess on the side of that is also, we have a huge number of repeat prescriptions to sign often, and you're under a lot of time pressure to kind of do them. So it's kind of like that kind of time pressure, along with actually if you want to have quality prescribing, and sometimes you do need to look in the notes to make sure that the prescribing is right, and any hospital letters we've put the prescriptions on and they kind of match up with what's being said. So yeah, kind of really interesting area, and I guess one that can continue to be looked at in general practice. Great, yeah. Thanks very much, Sally. Very interesting talks with you.
You were listening to EKU 10 podcasts from the Royal College of General Practitioners.